casting a ballot in this year's elections is critical to the future, but if you live in California, make sure you have the ballot for the party you want to vote for. On Inside, we'll go to the source to clear up any voter registration confusion. Secretary of State Alex Padilla will join me to talk about the early primary, voter registration, and what for some is confusing, that no party preference situation. Then, a conversation with retired Army Colonel Peter Mansour, who was raised in Sacramento, went on to West Point, and did two tours of duty during the Iraq War. He's the chair of military history at Ohio State. We'll get his reaction to what's happening in Iran. At the end of the hour, a few of the 140 films featured at this year's Wild and Scenic Film Festival, and that includes 16 world premieres. I'm Beth Ruyak. It's all coming up today on Insight. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. You might be hearing a lot about voter registration this week. California's primary is March 3rd, not in June, as it has been in recent years. And with the holidays now behind us, the primary suddenly seems soon, doesn't it? There's a little bit of confusion, though, like what to do, because this is a presidential primary, and if you've been a no-party preference voter, you need to request a certain ballot. California Secretary of State Alex Padilla is joining us to sort out some of this confusion. He's at a studio on the campus of Cal State Northridge. Secretary Padilla, welcome back to Insight.
Good morning, Beth. Happy New Year and happy election year.
That's true. Happy New Year to you, too. Let's start with how many eligible California voters already have checked this off their list. They're registered and ready to vote.
Well, we have going into this election a record number of voters registered in the state of California, well more than 20 million. And frankly, growing by the day, growing almost by the hour. Imagine all the activity, not just on the campaign side, but folks going online to register to vote at registertovote.ca.gov, or registering to vote as they're conducting their business through the Department of Motor Vehicles and a couple of other state departments and agencies. So a record number of Californians getting ready for what's going to be a very consequential election.
Can you put this in context? How does this compare, for example, to 2016?
So we're up a couple million additional registered voters compared to where we were at this point 4 years ago. And I think not just from an overall number standpoint, but from, frankly, the percentage of eligible voters on the rolls today is at its highest point than it's been since 1952. So nearly 70-year high in terms of the number of eligible Californians on the rolls and ready to participate in, again, what I said is going to be a very consequential election.
So does this say something to you about the awareness of the early primary or the motivation to vote in what you just described as a consequential election, or maybe even that the process has gotten easier? What do you think?
I think it's a combination of things. I mean, as I travel up and down the state trying to get the word out about voter registration and the importance of voting, it is palpably different than it was even 4 or 5 years ago. Everybody's paying attention. There's communities that are excited. There's communities that are scared, given the political environment we're feeling across the country. There's a range of emotions, but the bottom line is pretty much everybody is aware there's an election coming up and everybody knows how important it is. I also think it is a result of California being much more relevant in a presidential primary process than we historically have been. As you mentioned, historically, California voters go to the polls in June, by which time, more often than not, the nominees for most of the major political parties have already been determined. At this go-around and going forward, Californians have a much bigger say on who the nominees will be for the political parties. And I think that's good for California, regardless of who ends up in the White House. And I also have to emphasize, I think, a big reason for the level of registration that we see and the level of participation we anticipate seeing is a result of some intentional policy initiatives that we have championed the last few years, not just online voter registration, not just automatic voter registration, not just pre-registration for 16 and 17-year-olds, but the reforms we're putting in place to make it easier for registered voters to be able to cast their ballot, through in-person early voting, more vote by mail, same-day voter registration, things of that nature. So you take all these things together, and I'm looking forward to an epic and historic civic participation year when it comes to the primary election, of course, the November election, and when time allows, we can come back and talk more about the decennial census as well.
Same-day registration, you just used that phrase. So here's a bit of maybe misunderstanding or misinformation. There's a voter registration deadline, supposedly of February 18th, and yet we do have same-day registration. So what applies in the primary, and why the deadline?
I think the main context to understand here is that California leads the nation both on maintaining the security and integrity of our elections, but also in making participation as accessible as possible to anybody and everybody who's eligible. You know, we talked about the voter registration options that people have. Once upon a time, there was a voter registration cutoff. It used to be a month before the election. Why? Because counties needed time to, stop adding names. We got to go to the printer, print out these voter lists that we need to distribute at every polling place on election day. Well, that turned out to be an artificial deadline given technology and, you know, policies that we can put in place now. The registration deadline was moved to 2 weeks before the election, and now we know we have a way with the proper security measures in place to allow people to register to vote up to, including on election day, or update their voter registration and still process that registration and have somebody's ballot counted. We want to do anything we can to make sure anybody who's eligible has the opportunity to have their voice heard in our democracy. So removing the artificial registration deadline is one of those strategies.
So in a way, that February 18th date becomes somewhat of a priority deadline, but the truth is you could register on primary day, March 3rd, and still cast a ballot and have it be counted, correct?
Exactly. And don't get me wrong, we want to encourage people to register to vote or to update their registration as soon as possible. But for those who may procrastinate, we know there's a couple of Californians in that category. We see it every cycle. We want to make sure that we remove any unnecessary barriers from them being able to participate in the election. So the couple of bits of advice that we're giving anybody and everybody is, number one, if you believe you're a registered voter, go to voterstatus.sos.ca.gov. It's a tool on the Secretary of State's website, and verify your registration status and your information. You see that you need to update your address, or maybe your political party preference or your vote by mail preference, then of course you go to registertovote.ca.gov. That second site is for anybody who needs to register to vote for the first time, or to quickly, easily update your voter registration. We want to make sure that your registration information is as up-to-date and accurate as possible so we can be as prepared as we can going into the March 3rd election.
I'm talking with California Secretary of State Alex Padilla. In fact, Sacramento County just sent out a notice that it just mailed a voter registration status postcard. And every registered voter will get this in the county. That does speak to the fact that every county is handling its elections its own way. So how you vote and the kind of communication you get may vary county to county. And all those websites that you just listed, Secretary Padilla, we'll post a link to on our website as well. I think we can't get enough information out there. If 80% of eligible Californians are registered, it means that roughly 20% are not, and that could change a lot of outcomes. So how do you reach those people?
Yeah, well, we don't give up. You know, we continue to try to get the word out through traditional media, through social media, through a lot of public events and in partnership with community organizations. And frankly, we try to make it as easy and simple as possible, you know, through online registration, through automatic registration, you know, by going directly to colleges, universities, naturalization ceremonies, anywhere and everywhere we can. Thankfully, as I mentioned, a lot of people are paying attention. And we see upticks on our online voter registration site whenever there's a, you know, we're going to see it the day of the Iowa caucuses like we have in previous cycles. We're going to see it the day that New Hampshire and other earlier states go to vote. Every time there's a debate of some sort, we see an uptick in inquiries and registration. So we're going to keep moving the needle. Our job is not done till we hit 100%, both on the registration side and on the turnout side. But we're certainly in a much stronger place than we have been in the past.
Perhaps what's been most confusing is what the no party preference voters, who were also called declined a state in past elections, need to do to make sure that they vote, because a presidential primary is different. It's the party that matters this time around. So let's try to work our way through this right now. Are you surprised that this has been such an issue? There's genuine fear that a lot of ballots won't be counted or won't be cast the way voters want to cast them.
All right. So if the question is, am I surprised? The answer is no, because there was a similar, both some confusion and some misinformation that was there but 4 years ago. So the important thing, again, to remember is this: California goes out of its way to make sure that anybody who's eligible can easily register to vote and will have their voice heard in the election. Now, there are some rules that are in place for the presidential primary specifically. Right in California, we now have this top two vote getter system that we all enjoy, we've gotten used to. For most other races, your political party preference as a voter really doesn't matter. You can vote for anybody, regardless of the candidate's political party. The top two vote getters advance to the November general election. Sounds straightforward, and it is. This presidential primary is the exception. When people are running for president of the United States, the political parties determine the rules. And so, of course, if you're a registered Republican, you can choose among the Republican candidates for president. If you're a registered Democrat, you can choose amongst the Democratic candidates for president, so on down the line. If you're a no-party preference voter, and it's not insignificant, we have a large and growing number of voters who prefer no-party preference, you do have to pay attention to the rules a little bit. Your default ballot is what we refer to as a nonpartisan ballot, because you've selected to have no party preference. So there will not be candidates for president that appear on the ballot, but if you choose to vote for a candidate for president, you do have options to do so. There's some political parties who have opted to allow for what's known as crossover voting. The Democratic Party, the American Independent Party, for example, what you have to do as a no-party preference voter is advise the county, either in advance if you vote by mail or when you walk into the polling place on election day or the vote center if you're in one of those counties, and request either Democratic Party ballot, a Peace and Freedom ballot, a Democratic Party ballot, American Independent ballot, or Libertarian Party ballot. Those three parties are allowing for crossover voting by no party preference voters in their primaries. The other political parties are what we refer to as closed primaries. So if you're a no party preference voter and you want to vote in the Republican Party for a Republican candidate, for example, then you have to re-register as a Republican to be able to receive that Republican ballot, cast that ballot. If you keep that registration going forward, or you change it back to no party preference later, that's up to you. Again, our job in California and the Secretary of State's office, in partnership with all the counties, is making it as easy as possible for any eligible voter to register and for every voter to be able to cast their ballot and, to, of course, to have their vote counted and counted as cast. So no party preference voters got to pay a little bit of attention, follow these rules. As part of these efforts, counties throughout the state are sending notices, for the most part, in the form of postcards to no party preference voters saying, hey, you know, we have this presidential primary coming up. Here are the rules. Your default ballot will be this. But if you have a preference for one of these partisan crossover ballots, let us know in advance so elections officials have time to process those requests and make sure that particularly vote-by-mail voters get the specific ballot that they would prefer for this March 3rd primary.
I think an important clue to this is when you get your ballot mailed to you in advance, which most people in California do, if you see no presidential candidates on it, that's a good sign that somehow you're still in this no party preference category, and then you can reach out to your county or, as you said, go that particular day. The information takes us all a lot into the weeds, and it's less than 2 million people in the vast state of California that affects. But again, it's a group of voters that could make all the difference in a local, a county, or even a statewide race.
Exactly, exactly. And so, again, just as with everything else, you know, get informed, have a plan, prepare early, and similar to the voter registration deadline, while of course we want to encourage every voter to return those postcards or contact their county elections office and let their preference for what ballot they want to receive be known. If you happen to miss the deadline, if you lost those postcards, you still have options, including going into the county elections office or showing up at your polling place on election day through same-day registration. You can make any changes you need. But when you get that ballot, if you don't have presidential candidates listed on it and you want to vote for a candidate for president, bring that ballot back in to the polling place. We will replace it with the ballot of your choice. That same-day registration that we spoke of earlier, by the way, is no longer just available in county elections offices. That was the case a couple of years ago. Now every polling place and every vote center will offer same-day registration.
All right. The vote-by-mail ballots will go out February 3rd with prepaid postage return envelopes. One last question, which I would have asked anyway, but we're in times of particular concern about cybersecurity or the unknowns, the unexpecteds. What about security with our ballots, security at polling places, and that kind of voting issue?
Right. No, great question. Very timely. You know, maybe come back and do a whole more in-depth show on this, but the bottom line voters should be aware of is California leads the nation on election security. The voting systems each and every county uses in the state of California has to be tested and certified for use first, meaning that it meets California's security standards, which exceed what the federal government advises for voting systems. Number two, California requires paper ballots. Paper ballots and a voter-verified paper trail for all voters. Number three, we prohibit counties from connecting their voting equipment to the internet. So all the voting systems that we use, anything you use to mark a ballot, to cast a ballot, to count ballots, cannot be connected to the internet, making it impossible to systematically hack or rig an election. And we require every county to conduct a post-election audit after every election. There's a lot more to it than that. We won't get into firewalls and encryption technology on this show, but rest assured, Californians, we as a state lead the nation on election security. We're constantly vigilant, constantly monitoring. You know, the events of this last week, you know, we'll treat no different. We're always on alert, and we'll protect the integrity of our most fundamental democratic institutions.
Well, thank you, Secretary Padilla. We made more time for this than we expected. I appreciate you extending this conversation, and thanks for joining us from the Cal State Northridge campus.
Thank you, Beth. Have a great day.
We have posted a link to the Secretary of State's website. There is so much election and voter information there, but you can also check with your county registrar for questions that you might have about voting where you live. Up next, I'll talk with Dr. Peter Mansour about the situation in Iran. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. The burial of Qasem Soleimani, scheduled today, has been postponed, we understand, because of a human stampede. At least 50 people have been reported killed, more than 200 injured. During yesterday's funeral, Soleimani's daughter, Zainab, added to the threats of retaliation. Here's a little bit of what she said.
در نبردهای سوریه، عراق، و لبنان و افغانستان و یمن و فلسطین بودند در انتظار مرگ فرزندانشان روزهایشان را سپری خواهند کرد.
CNN's translation of her speaking in her native language is this. Families of the American soldiers in Western Asia have witnessed America's humiliation in Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, Afghanistan, Yemen, and Palestine wars, and will spend their days waiting for the death of their children. For many Americans, Soleimani's death revives history and memories. And on the phone from Ohio State University is Peter Mansour, a retired Army colonel. He was raised in Sacramento. He became executive officer to General David Petraeus during 15 months of the Iraq surge. That started in 2007. Dr. Mansour, thanks for joining us again. It's terrific to have you back on Insight.
Great to be on, Beth. Thanks for inviting me.
I realize that we are among a number of people reaching out to you about your time in Iraq. What was your engagement or interaction, if you had any, with the general?
Well, I was his chief of staff, of his personal staff, so I basically lived with him 24/7. My bedroom was right next door to his. My office was right next door to his. I traveled with him, so it was constant interaction.
So that's referencing General David Petraeus and the U.S. side. What about your group of leadership interacting with General Soleimani then?
Oh, I see. You know, we had zero interaction with Soleimani. He never entered Iraq, to my knowledge, during the Iraq War. If he did, it was surreptitious and went unnoticed. He became a much more public figure during the war against ISIS, where he was a social media darling. He'd take selfies with Shiite soldiers on the front lines of the war, and that's when he became a much more noticeable figure.
It's said that he was directly responsible for the deaths of at least 600 servicemen during the Iraq War, the wounding of tens of thousands of others. What was your general knowledge about what he was responsible for and how he was directing it?
Well, this was a real problem. He was directly responsible for arming, training, and directing Shiite militias in attacks against U.S. forces. Iran provided these militia groups with explosively formed penetrators, which are powerful enough to destroy an M1 tank. And when those went off and they actually hit a vehicle, the result was the maiming or deaths of our service members, and at least 600 died at the hands of these devices. And so, when I reached out to my fellow veterans following Soleimani's demise, everyone was, the first word out of their mouths was, "This is justice."
How did you hear that he had been killed? What was your first thought?
I was actually in an airport traveling, and my wife showed me a breaking news story, and that was my first thought as well. This is justice for those 600 or so Americans who were killed and the thousands others who were maimed by the devices that this guy provided to our enemies in Iraq. My second thought was, wow, this was a really big step in the escalation of the conflict against Iran, and it has very uncertain ramifications going forward.
Tell me about that choice at this time, because in the news today is the discussion that President Trump had a number of options or strategies before him, that this drone strike and this killing of Soleimani and the others was a choice. Give me your view of that move at this point in time.
So I believe the president had to reestablish a measure of deterrence in the Gulf region. Iran had been attacking U.S. interests and those of our allies for over a year. They've attacked oil tankers in the Gulf. They've attacked Saudi oil facilities. They downed one of our drones. And I think for the president, the red line was their rocketing of our bases in Iraq, which killed a contractor, an American contractor, and wounded several American soldiers, and then the attack against our embassy, which he directed. And so that, having crossed that red line, the question is now, what are you going to do? You have to push back somehow. I think killing Soleimani was on the list of options, but it was well down the list because it's such a big step. There were probably other actions that he could have taken that were of a lesser nature that still would have pushed back without leading to an escalation that could lead to war.
There was no congressional approval, and a briefing is expected tomorrow afternoon for the Senate, possibly the House. Again, I ask your take, Dr. Mansour, about that approach to this. And in the moment of a decision, would any military leader have questioned whether Congress was involved or had a role?
No. The Constitution gives the president great powers as commander-in-chief, and one of those powers is the right of self-defense for American forces. Soleimani had directed attacks against American forces. He was planning other attacks against American forces, and so he was a legitimate target. You can argue about whether we should have killed him or not, but I don't think you can argue that somehow Congress had to be informed ahead of time, because there was attacks being planned by Soleimani and the forces under his control against American troops.
Do you know any more about what might have been planned than what's been reported, which is essentially nothing at this point?
No, the notification in accordance with the War Powers Act that went to Congress was classified, so I'm not privy to it. But knowing what has happened in the past and the attacks that the rocket attacks that have already occurred against U.S. forces in Iraq, and there were more than just the one that killed the contractor, I'm certain that there were more attacks planned.
Do you know of any other previous conversations about attempts to kill this general in any way? And I know that your time goes back more than 10 years, but how plugged in, I guess, are you to what's happening that's out of the mainstream, unclassified arena?
Yeah, I'm not aware, at least during the Iraq War prior to 2011, when we left, of any discussions about targeting Soleimani. There were more pressing issues, especially al-Qaeda and Iraq, that we had to deal with. We did talk about Iranian intervention in the war and what to do about it, but the decision at that time by President Bush was to launch negotiations with Iraqi or Iranian interlocutors in Baghdad. So, and General Petraeus and Ambassador Ryan Crocker were part of those negotiations. We were trying to come to an accommodation with Iran at that time rather than a confrontation.
You're listening to retired Army Colonel Dr. Peter Mansour. He commanded the 1st Brigade, 1st Armored Division from 2003 to 2005, and that included 13 months in combat in support of Operation Iraqi Freedom. By the way, his brigade was awarded a President Unit Citation for collective valor in combat. And then, as you've heard us reference, he was Executive Secretary to General David Petraeus during the Iraq War surge. In listening to news reports over the past few days, do you find yourself wanting to add anything or clarify anything about the picture of who General Soleimani was and his role in the politics and the violence of the Middle East?
Yeah, I think most Americans don't have a very good idea of who this person was. He was the head of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Quds Force. It is sort of a mixture in U.S. terms of our Special Operations Command, our Central Command, and our Central Intelligence Agency. He had responsibility for Iranian dealings in Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, the Gaza Strip, and Afghanistan, basically everywhere where he would bump up against the United States. In fact, at one point in those negotiations I referenced with Iranian interlocutors, the president of Iraq, Jalal Talabani, got a text message from Qasem Soleimani, and he passed the phone to General Petraeus, and the message read, "General Petraeus, I'm Qasem Soleimani. If you want to talk about the future of Iraq, you better talk to me, because I'm the one with the portfolio for that country." In other words, the people we were talking to, the official diplomats, were powerless, and he was the one that had all the power. So he was a very powerful figure. He was instrumental in forming these Shiite militia groups, proxy forces in Iraq and Syria and Lebanon and other places, and directing them in operations against U.S. forces, against members of our coalition allies, and against other groups.
So his death has left then a wide landscape of the desire for revenge. You heard the remarks made by Soleimani's daughter. You've read the reports, and the threats of retaliation are coming from many places, many countries. What now, Dr. Mansour? What can we expect?
Well, I think that Iran will attempt to retaliate in some manner. I'd be surprised if they launched a conventional strike against U.S. forces, because that would lead to certain retaliation and an escalation to all-out war. It's more likely that they'll try something that has more plausible deniability, like a terror attack, maybe a cyber attack, or even using their proxy forces around the Middle East to attack U.S. forces or civilians or those of our allies. The thing about it is, though, is that given the proximity of any retaliatory attacks, even if they're by proxy groups, to this this event, I think the Trump administration isn't going to be fooled that Iran is behind it. And I think that U.S. retaliation for Iranian retaliation is also certain. And this, the question is now, is how do you get out of this escalatory cycle, which, you know, if it taken to an extreme, will lead to a regional conflict?
How do you? With the knowledge you have and the fact that you're the chair of military history at Ohio State University, how do you back out of escalation like this?
Yeah, I think the only way is to launch a diplomatic initiative out of the public eye. You have to find a way to get Iranians into a room or some sort of channel of communication with American diplomats and figure out a way ahead where neither side loses face and where you can de-escalate the cycle of violence. I would say that if this administration does that, it would surprise me, given the bellicose rhetoric of the president and his actions. He's a very unpredictable leader, and again, I'd be very surprised if we take that route. I think more likely we're on a path to escalation at this point.
Which then would mean what? And do we keep troops in Iraq right now? I'm sure you have an adamant opinion about that, as do many people with military experience in the Middle East.
The keeping troops in Iraq is really, I'd say it's a different issue. It's connected, obviously, because of the Iranian relationship with the Iraqi government. But those troops, 5,000 of them, are there to train Iraqi security forces and to conduct counter-terror missions against ISIS. Those troops aren't necessarily there to counter Iran. It obviously enabled the drone strike against Qasem Soleimani, but primarily those troops are there to fight ISIS. And it's in Iraq's interest to keep them there. They don't want to fight ISIS alone. The last time they tried that, they almost got overrun. So I think that vis-a-vis Iraq, we have to wait until there's a new government in place, one that has the authority to negotiate the presence of U.S. forces going forward, and maybe come to some sort of formal agreement on what can and can't be done by those forces in the future, so that, you know, something like this doesn't happen again, where the Iraqis are surprised by our actions.
To what degree is Iraq divided over the troops continuing to be there?
Well, that's precisely the point. Everyone knows that the Iraqi Council of Representatives voted to kick the U.S. troops out, but it was 170 representatives that did that. They were all Shiites. There are 368 representatives in the parliament, though, and most of them didn't show up for the vote. The Sunnis and Kurds boycotted it because they want American forces to remain in Iraq. They view America as a counterweight against Iran. They don't want the Iraqi government to become, basically a vassal state of the Iranian Empire. And so there is a very divided polity in Iraq today. And the United States, you know, has to be aware of that when we negotiate with the Iraqi government.
I'm talking with Dr. Peter Mansour. He is at Ohio State University. He was raised in Sacramento, was valedictorian at Mira Loma High School, and then went on to West Point, where in the past stories you've told me, Dr. Mansour, you really grew up at West Point. That was the place where you became a man and the rest of your life unfolded before you. So is your family contacting you and saying, how much should we be afraid at this point in time?
Yeah, first, go Matadors. yes, actually, my kids and I had a long chat yesterday. I'm in contact with my family. Of course, they can also watch me on CNN and some other outlets that I've been on recently, and I share that on social media as well. So, what I find amazing is if my family, which is pretty tuned in politically, has questions about what's going on, you know, I can imagine what most Americans think or don't think about what's going on. And I think there's way too much politics being injected into the killing of Qasem Soleimani. I think that's inevitable, but I think it's very important for the Americans to understand basically the strategic rationale or lack thereof behind this action, the ramifications of it, the potential for escalation, and why Qasem Soleimani was a target in the first place.
So have you heard the rumor or the conversation that's been going around about the bounty that's been put on President Trump's head? I found myself going to Snopes this morning trying to do some fact-checking on this.
I haven't heard anything about that. It's not unusual for people to want to kill the President of the United States. Several presidents have been assassinated. He's got very thorough security around him, so I wouldn't imagine that would have an impact one way or the other on his governing style.
Given that, then, and in light of what you just said about your own conversations with your family, what should we be paying attention to in the days ahead, assuming that we're going to hear more details at some point in time about how this happened, but to our daily lives and the fears that we might have, what do you say?
I think America's pretty safe. If there are actions taken by Iran in the United States, it would lead to certain retaliation, a war that would be painful for the United States but devastating to Iran. I'm not sure that they would take that leap. I think Americans really need to look past the political rhetoric. If you listen to the Democrats, this was an illegal action by the president who didn't consult Congress, and it's idiotic strategic move. And if you listen to the Republicans, President Trump is the second coming of John Wayne and took necessary steps to guard our security. I think you need to go beyond that and look at our relationship with Iran since 1979, the Iranian Revolution, the fact that Iran, quite frankly, has been at war with the United States for more than 40 years, and Americans really haven't realized that until recently. And then go to, well, what's the future of this? Do we want a war in the Middle East? Absolutely not. But what's the alternative now vis-a-vis our relations with Iraq and Iran? I think Americans, we want to be rid of that region, but the region will not be rid of us. And so it behooves Americans to get smarter on what's going on there.
Thank you so much for your perspective and for your time. It's always a pleasure, and you know you have a standing invitation to come to the studio whenever you're back in Sacramento.
Thanks, Beth. Looking forward to it. Next December.
Okay. It's a deal.
All right.
Thank you so much. That was Dr. Peter Mansour, retired Army colonel. He's an author, commentator, and the chair of military history at Ohio State University. One of his three books, by the way, is about his experience during the Iraq War. It's titled Surge. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. All right, let's give you a little bit of entertainment to look ahead to. One of the most popular film festivals for fans of environmental and activist movies is the Wild and Scenic Film Festival in Nevada City and Grass Valley, California. It returns January 16th to the 20th more than 140 film choices with 16 world premieres. In the studio with me back for a visit is Melinda Booth. She is a past director of the festival, now executive director of South Yuba River Citizens League, which presents the festival. Hi, Melinda.
Good
glad
morning.
To have you here. What's the story behind that title, Wild and Scenic?
Sure. So we named this film festival in honor of the South Yuba River Citizens League big win back in 1999 of securing wild and scenic status for 39 miles of the South Yuba River. And that's why the organization was formed, was to protect that river.
So this year's theme is regeneration, meaning what?
Yeah, so every year we try to come up with a theme that we feel like is going to be meaningful and relevant and be able to be expressed through film and art. And this year, the theme really gestures towards renewal and the possibilities of how to restore the earth and the human communities while creating a positive future for the next generation.
Let me just say the artwork on this year's program is truly stunning. Drawings of everything from the bear to the eagle to the trout to the birds, the frogs. Who did this?
We're so thrilled with our artwork this year. Artist, naturalist, and author Obi Kaufman drew this artwork for us, and we're just thrilled to have it. And he's going to be at the festival as well and have some art on exhibit and also be doing a live drawing, which is really exciting to have him there.
All right. So there are workshops, art exhibits, there's music, programs for young people. You can meet filmmakers and activists and special guests. Let's get to a clip of a movie right now. And we're going to start with a movie titled Sea of Shadows. Do you want to give a brief overview before we listen?
Sure. So Sea of Shadows takes place in the Sea of Cortez, and it's really about an effort to save one of the most endangered species on the planet, the vaquita, which is a small dolphin. And there's some illegal trade happening of a fish species, and the vaquita is a bycatch. So it's seriously endangered. And this is a multi-agency and organizational effort to try and save this species.
If we don't save the vaquita, we will lose the most beautiful places on the planet. I keep thinking about the moment when only one vaquita would be left in the wild.
This is a war against the extinction of a species.
We have to hold on to the hope that it's going to work.
The poachers are unacceptable. They'll take any means necessary.
Clock's ticking.
We will fight for every single life. We won't stop.
So that is Sea of Shadows. When's the opportunity to see that film?
That is going to screen twice at the festival, so you can check it out Saturday midday at our Osborne Woods Hall venue or Sunday afternoon at the Nevada Theater.
Now let's go to what I'm going to say is an intimate, close-to-home film. This one is titled The Sacramento at Current Speed. So we're going to begin by listening to a clip which will tell you a lot about this film.
I have this idea in my head of a perfect river, a long, slow river, where you have the time to feel the current under your oars. Go as long as you want, 30, 40, 100 miles. If you're lucky, maybe see some wildlife, sleep on an empty sand beach, wake up to the sound of a noisy beaver. And then to stumble on this place and find that it really exists and that it's here, almost in my own backyard.
I'm sure a lot of people wonder why rowing 300 miles down the Sacramento seemed like a good idea. To some people it's perfectly self-evident. There's the Huck Finn aspect of being able to just row away from our troubles for a little bit and float down the river at current speed for a while.
Like most people, my knowledge of the Sacramento came from a glimpse out of a car window on Interstate 80. Then slowly, section by section, I started to get to know this place, to see what was down here, and I wondered, how far could I go? I knew the section below Redding pretty well, but on the map, it looked like it might be possible to row all the way to the Delta, 300 miles, right down the center of California.
Who knew how long that float could be and that you could do it? Just listening to the clip, not even seeing the full film, I'm there.
I know it's there. In our backyard, and it's wild and an amazing experience of nature in our backyard.
All right. So when and where to see this film?
So that also plays twice, Saturday afternoon at the Nevada Theater, or you can catch it Sunday morning at the Gold Miners Inn.
We've posted a link to all the information about the upcoming 18th annual Wild and Scenic Film Festival. Melinda Booth is in the studio with me. We have time for one more. It's titled Life of Pi. It is not the Academy Award-winning Life of Pi, P-I, but this is P-I-E, and it has to do with pizza pie and mountain biking.
Yeah, so it's a little bit lighter of a film. It's one of our adventure shorts and really talks about community and about people who care about a landscape, making a life and valuing place and figuring out how to make it all work.
Let's listen to a clip.
Isn't there a Susan B. Anthony quote about riding bikes? Something like, I'm gonna trash this, but something about that was like the best invention to emancipate women was the bicycle. Something along those lines. Because it gave people freedom. And I know when I was a teenager and stuck in my own skin trying to figure out who the hell I was, and I would just go ride my bike. For me personally, it just soothes my soul.
And that's that takes us back to 2002 and two mountain bikers who are also entrepreneurs who were looking for a place and freedom to ride, and pizza works in there somewhere.
Right. So they decided to settle in the little town of Fruita, Colorado, and started a pizza restaurant. And I've actually been there on my last road trip.
What was the yardstick or the criteria for inviting filmmakers in? This film festival has now become so popular that I know you get hundreds of entries.
Right. We review so many films, and we really try to pick the films that are telling the stories that are timely, that are telling an inspiring story, and are going to be able to resonate with people, that people are going to want to watch and come away from feeling like they want to take action and make a difference, and also feeling like they can and it's worthwhile. We do need to stay hopeful in these times.
Some additional films to mention, one particularly scenically beautiful, takes us through the Grand Canyon.
Yes, Into the Canyon. It is a visually stunning film, you're right. Photojournalist Pete McBride, author Kevin Fidarko, both past attendees at the film fest. We've had other films from Pete as well. And they decide to do a continuous hike through the Grand Canyon. And so most people go through the Grand Canyon on a boat if they're going to go through it, or they hike down and back out. But Pete and Kevin decide to walk the length of the Grand Canyon on foot. And that's a treacherous expedition, in fact.
And when and where does that one show?
Into the Canyon, we also have screening twice. I'm going to look it up just real quick because I don't know off the top of my head.
The program is fabulous, by the way. Alphabetic order with descriptions and information about the films.
72-page book about the festival.
Wow.
But you can catch Into the Canyon Saturday night at Osborne Woods or midday on Sunday at the Nevada Theater.
Okay. And just a quick note about how you've engaged young people in the area.
Sure. So youth is a big part of what we do. And so we actually have some programming for youth that happens even pre-official fest. So we curate three different programs for youth, K through 12, and offer in theater screenings for kids to come and join. But we also have family-friendly 3D films that kick off the festival on Thursday night. We do a Saturday morning session of films for youth, our Saturday morning kid films. We have a youth workshop that we have happening. It's this year, a Youth Rise Up, a student activist play shop. So folks can come out and get involved and find young colleagues who are inspired to take action and interested in the environment.
Melinda, I think this is your life. I really do. But for people who are making it their life and their love, the workshops are critical. What are the possibilities for learning and growing at the festival?
Sure. So it's not just film, as you've done a good job explaining. That's the core and the center of what we do. But there's so much more happening at the festival. We have activist workshops for youth and for adults, for folks of all ages. But all day Saturday and all day Sunday, next weekend, you can check out an activist workshop for free. We have over 10 workshops. We have coffee talks. We have fireside chats where you actually can dive into some of these issues. You come away from some of these films, they're heavy, and you want to talk about them, and you want to connect and learn more. And so some of these workshops and talks are a way to actually dive in deeper and engage and to talk to experts in the field.
What else to know for first-time festival goers? Anything to bring? Anything to be aware of? Parking issues?
Oh, parking's always a challenge in our little foothills town, but there's ways around it, and we have information on our website about how to make it as easy as possible. So just be willing to walk a little bit. Wear your layers, right? It's cold outside in January, and it's warm inside the film venues, but just come with an open mind, and anywhere you end up, I think you're going to be surprised at what you'll have with the programming that you'll have in front of you. It's really content rich material.
Well, kudos to you and your team of young and inspired people who have not only done a terrific job in outreach, but continue to let everybody know in terms of the opportunities there to participate, to learn, and to grow. Once again, it's not this weekend, it is next weekend in Nevada City and Grass Valley, January 16th to the 20th. Thank you so much. Good luck with the festival.
Thank you.
Melinda Booth. And we are talking about the 18th Annual Wild and Scenic Film Festival. It's in Nevada City in Grass Valley, California. You can find information at capradio.org/insight. And that's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruiak with producers Helen Barrington, Cynthia Lopez. And we want to extend a warm welcome to our newest producer, Kyle McKinnon, who has joined our team in this new year. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, and Helga Salinas. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Our engineer is Antonio Munez. Insight's managing editor is Aram Sarkissian. And Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. Thanks for joining us. We're back with another live show tomorrow.